I'll introduce our speaker this morning. Dodie Ferguson is a member of the Cowessess First Nation, which is located in southeast Saskatchewan, in and along the Qu'Appelle Valley. Growing up in a farming and ranching family on her nation, Dodie learned the importance of respecting the land and its inhabitants for this and future generations. As a postal worker in the city of Regina, Dodie participates as an advocate for Indigenous people and Indigenous rights locally and nationally. And so she's our special guest speaker today, and I understand is going to lead our circle.
Okay. We're on?
Okay, perfect. Oop.
Just waiting for my speaker to turn on. So yes, I am from Cowessess First Nation. I was born and raised there. It was my privilege and my honor to grow up on my nation from the time I was born to the time I left to come to the city. The first time I actually seen a diverse group of people was in grade 4. At that time, my father decided that we were no longer going to go to school on the reserve, and he wanted us to go to the town school. And when my sister and I asked why, he said to us, "I need you to have an education where you can talk to our white neighbors." And that was his word, white neighbors. I call other people other than an Indigenous settler. So he said, "You need to have that white man's education in order to talk to our neighbors and to make you successful. Because if I leave you on the reserve and I let you stay on the reserve to go to school, you will not have the ability to talk to others, because I've seen it myself." So the first time I actually seen a large group of non-Indigenous people was in grade 4. Other than that, I went to town on Saturdays with my mom to get groceries and to do laundry. So I think I come from a place of privilege where I was able to walk both sides. I have that ability for a variety of reasons. And as much as my sister and I resisted my father's teachings, my father's decision, we had to honor it. And without my father's pushing and support, I wouldn't be here today. So I always like to acknowledge my parents when I start these kind of things. I'm just going to start my program here from the very beginning, because I think you guys deserve to hear it from the beginning. It doesn't want to listen to me today. I had this all queued up when I left the house. Okay, so reconciliation in the watershed. Where did it come from? Reconciliation actually started with Justice Murray Sinclair. And it actually came out of the Indian Residential School Resolution Agreement. What people don't realize when it comes, when we talk about truth and reconciliation, is the truth and reconciliation actually started back in the early 90s. Does anyone remember something called OCA? Yes. We heard about a lot in the media called the OCA crisis. Indigenous people call it the OCA resistance. What was going on was started in the 1700s with OCA. Back then, a church group took care of the land, stewards of the land for the Indigenous people. And over time, that became ownership. And over time, people stopped, you know, noticing the cultural significance of the pines in OCA. And the pines at OCA in Conestataki and Mohawk territory, they were actually burial grounds. They were the resting place of people's ancestors. And what happened was that one of the nearby municipalities wanted to expand their golf course into the pines. So imagine that. Someone trying to put a golf course over your ancestor. Understandably, from that perspective, looking back 2020, I think we can understand why there was a resistance. And you can talk about it in your future discussions about the bias of media. Because I think a lot of us remember that Pulitzer Prize winning picture of an Indigenous man with his face covered and a young, fresh-faced soldier facing him down. You could see the gun behind the warrior, as it were. And all you see was this little guy. But if you would have panned out and seen that picture larger, you would have realized there was only 50 Mohawk people there, and there were 1,500 soldiers. And that gentleman who looked like he was unarmed actually had his machine gun blow. And that Mohawk warrior actually wasn't a Mohawk at all. He was an economic student from the University of Saskatchewan who went down there to stand in support with those resistors. So we need to talk in terms of our reconciliations about media and media bias and how it changes the dialogue of something. So OCA happened. And after OCA happened, what came about was a royal report on the status of Aboriginal people. And out of that report came the decision and the admittance of wrongs in our residential school system, which led to the Indian Residential School Resolution Agreement, which was took many years to for the governments to hammer out. And then out of that came the Truth and Reconciliation Report from Justice Murray Sinclair. This guy is one of my favorites. He changed the way we talk about royal reports. I'm hoping my audio was loud for you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Murray Sinclair. I'm the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. I want to talk to you for a few minutes about the issue of reconciliation, something which, of course, is very important to us here at the Commission, but also is of interest and importance to a lot of people in Canada. One of the things that we at the Commission have discovered is that it took us a long time to get to this point in terms of the relationship between Aboriginal people in this country. Seven generations of children went through the residential schools. And each of those children who were educated were told that their lives were not as good as the lives of the non-Aboriginal people of this country. They were told that their languages, their cultures were irrelevant. They were told that their people and their ancestors were heathens and pagans and uncivilized. They needed to give up that way of life to come to a different way of living. At the same time that that was going on, non-Aboriginal children in the non-Aboriginal school systems of this country were also being told the same thing about Aboriginal people. So as a result, many generations of children, including you and your parents, have been raised to think about things in a different way, in the wrong way, in a way that is negative when it comes to Aboriginal people. And we need to change that. It was the educational system that has contributed to this problem in this country. And it's the educational system, we believe, that's going to help us to get away from this. We need to look at the way that we educate children. We need to look at the way that we educate ourselves. We need to look at what it is that our textbooks say about Aboriginal people. We need to look at what it is that Aboriginal people themselves are allowed to say within the educational system about their own histories. In addition to that, we also believe that what's important when it comes to looking at the way that children are educated is to understand that because it took us so many generations to get to this point, it's going to take us at least a few generations to be able to say that we are making progress. We cannot look for quick and easy solutions because there are none. We need to be able to look at this from the perspective of where do we want to be in 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 generations from now when we talk about the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in this country. And if we can agree on what that relationship needs to look like in the future, then what we need to think about is what can we do today that will contribute to that objective. Reconciliation will be about ensuring that everything that we do today is aimed at that high standard of restoring that balance to that relationship.
So that is the overall premise of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. It's to change the dialogue that we have right now when it comes to Indigenous people. And a lot of that includes our natural wildlife and our natural environment. Calls to action come out of the Royal Report, which was quite different than any other Royal Report that was ever tabled before. Royal Reports were usually a big, long document that you read through, very legalese, very dry, very technical. Justice Murray Sinclair actually grew up on his nation, and he became a judge. He was picked for those very reasons. He had cultural ties to his home community. He had the cultural values there, and he could speak to the people when it came to talking about truth and reconciliation. Because he spoke the language, right? And he got what people were saying when they stood up in front of that podium and spoke about what happened to them. Because he too was educated that way. So he created calls to action. Now calls to action mean you have to do something. They're not just a report. So he put the onus on the people that read the report, and I'm really grateful to hear that you guys have a community, a focused group that's looking at those calls to action, because there are quite a few of them. And they are very much driven and directed towards organizations and our politicians and our government systems. But the reality is that there is onus on all of us to actually really look at those and see where we can do something very tangible to make those differences. And I'm really appreciative that you actually invited me here to do this today, because that in itself is a reconciliation. To sit down and listen to something that you want to learn about, to make someone feel welcome in a society where we have been, as groups, trained to not talk to one another, That was a very deliberate and a very systemic action that created that division that did not allow us to talk to our neighbors and talk to our friends on an equitable level. So I need you to recognize that, and maybe that is one of your own personal calls to action, to start communicating and start talking and figuring out where you'd apply that. He spoke a lot about children. Children are the people that are the ones that are going to cause us to change our minds. I can come up here and I talk to 300 adults. But if we talk to children in their school systems and at home about this, it forces us as adults and the people that love them to assess ourselves and our critical thinking and think about things. And the reason why I bring this up is because I was doing facilitation training with my union up in Waskasu. And one of my sisters from Manitoba said, you know what? I'm very ashamed to admit that I know nothing about reconciliation. I know nothing about residential schools. And it really wasn't important to me until my 8-year-old came home one day and said, Mommy, do you know this happened? And this is what happened. And very elementary, like the school system was very respectful of the age and the well-being of that child. It didn't lump it all onto that child. It just spoke about it from a perspective that an 8-year-old could understand. And that mother said, you know what? Until that moment, I did not think about it. Until she came up to me and spoke to me about something she knew more about than I should as an adult, I did not really engage in the talk. I heard about it. I'd listened to it. It was on the media. The Cedar Box, I've seen when Justice Marin Sinclair took it to the ledge and tabled it, and it was there. You know, that our House of Parliament, our big, huge thing people should listen to. I seen it, but I didn't really think about it until she came home and said that. Mom, did you know that kids had to go away to school? Mommy, what would that mean for me? And she said to my chagrin, I was ashamed. I was ashamed that my 8-year-old brought home more education than I knew. So it forced me to educate myself so I could talk to her about this. She said, because until that moment, I didn't realize how important this was. So we need to, like, the beautiful thing is talking to your families about it and talking to your children about it, looking at the calls to action and figuring out where you as individuals can talk about that sort of thing. And now you know a little bit where truth and reconciliation came from. And part of that dialogue that needs to change is looking at how Indigenous people view water. We consider it essential to life. It's very factual, right? Studies show that we can't live without water, but neither can our natural environment. Neither can our habitat. A lot of our stuff that as Indigenous people, we live off of land. We live off of what we can harvest and catch, right? What we can collect and gather. Like in my family, we hunt every fall. We kill our own kill. We skin our own kill. We gut it. We process it. We smoke it. We wrap it. We freeze it. We do it from start to finish. And that is a simple thing of sustainability for us. It's about knowing that when we're eating something, we know where it came from. And I know a lot of my mom's family. She's from Treaty 6 territory, which is northern Saskatchewan-ish. She's from James Smith Cree Nation, which is by Melfort. A lot of those Indigenous elders there live on a natural diet, a traditional diet. They eat rabbit, they eat deer, they eat moose, they eat elk. They eat all of those things, geese, what have you. They forage off land, they eat the indigenous natural stuff, natural onions, natural horseradish. Like, these things are in our environment. We don't need to go to a grocery store for it. When the Husky oil spill happened in northern Saskatchewan River, the elders on that reserve noticed a change in their quality of their meat. And in fact, it started making them sick. So if our kill is making us sick, that means the things that are living on our land are getting sick because of the oil spills. And it's very important that we take care of our land, because if we don't take care of the land, if we don't take care of the water that feeds that land, it's going to affect us down the road. And we're seeing it now today. Like, if you look at the Athabasca Water Basin, and I'll show you a picture later on of the three main areas that our water drains into from the prairies. We need to look at that. We need to look at how we take care of that, because whatever happens upstream will go downstream. And we're always upstream or downstream from something, because it's all connected. There's no beginning, there's no end. And in fact, we don't even know what's going on with the water system as it is. As the human beings, we don't know how our water tables work. So we need to be conscious of what we do with it. And we're not being very conscious of that right now as a province. I need to be honest with that. Traditionally, water was also used for travel. We know a lot of things about canoes. We see about a lot. We even have Justin Trudeau talking about how Indigenous students and youth need these recreation centers to hang their canoe paddles off of. Well, if you're Innu, you won't need a canoe paddle. You'll need a kayak, you know, paddle. But, you know, he had kind of the right idea. He might have just not meant, you know, understood fully what he was talking about. Used a lot for travel, particularly here in the southern part of the province, we have the Capel Water System. I remember my father jumping in the canoe on spring breakup and riding down the river just because it was fast and because it was fun. But you also had people like him and my neighbors who go hunting and fishing off of the canoe. I have cousins that know how to manage a canoe and can look after themselves, right? So, you know, we have a great respect for the water because we need it to get around places than we did before. It was also essential water for medicinal use and for ceremonial use. You see a little cup of, we call that muskeg tea. It comes from northern Saskatchewan and from the coastal people where we, like, I trade for that muskeg tea. We also use water for our medicinal use in the sweat lodge, which is, that is a picture of. But we also use it to distill our medicines. There are four sacred medicines for us as Indigenous people. There's sage, which universally, if you look at other cultures, is a spiritual thing as well. It's a cleansing thing. It's a purifying thing, sage. No matter where you go, sage is there. So, you know, that tells me that as Indigenous people across the world, we understood the significance of Mother Nature's medicines that she gives us. We also have cedar. Cedar is actually used by our coastal brothers and sisters in their ceremony, much like sage. They dip it in water, the cedar bough, and they use it like a sweat, like a smudge. And then when they're done with that bough, they'll actually rinse it again and leave it out for Mother Nature to cleanse herself. So again, we're using water. We have tobacco, which we use to pray with, and it takes our prayers up to Creator and as Indigenous people. You can't grow tobacco without water. You can't grow tobacco without healthy land. And the fourth medicine, we have cedar, sage, tobacco, and we have sweetgrass. I do appreciate your hymn this morning, spoke about binding things together. Sweetgrass is grown close to a marshy area. So again, we need water to grow it, to have it grow healthily. And then we bind it three bundles of seven together to make the braid. One strand of sweetgrass is not strong, but you bind 21 together, and you're going to be hard to be breaking that thing apart. We also use water for sage in terms of medicinal uses. Sage is astringent when you boil it, and you let it sit in water overnight. The water you have left over once you strain the sage out of it is actually astringent, and it's cleansing, and it's you can use it for you know, skin conditions. And if you have acne, I've had friends have their acne clear up after using tetracycline and all these really rough acidic things on their face. They go to using the sage astringent and clear them right up. So we know water is essential to a lot of things, not only for ourselves but for Mother Earth. And we don't have our medicines if we don't keep the water safe ourselves. So when we talk about reconciliation in the watershed, we need to understand that it isn't just about us. It's about this whole beautiful valley. And you can't, it's really hard to see, but that is actually Crooked Lake in the Capella water system. And it's right near where I live. My parents live right on the top of the Capella Valley. We're about 5-10 minutes away from the river, the water. And growing up, I remember being able to go swimming in June. Beautiful thing, you know, recreation, swim, enjoy the water. Nowadays, I would not let my grandchildren get into that water, because we're always upstream or downstream from someone, and we're downstream from the city of Regina. And when you have the runoff from different farming communities, that water collects all those chemicals and those things left in the water from decades ago and from the soil from decades ago. It isn't just yesterday. It's from our farming practices from the 60s and 70s, 50s that are impacting our water system here in the southern Saskatchewan. It's all those chemicals being leached out of the soil into the water table under us, because water is underneath us. We can't see it. It's Mother Nature's lifeblood. That's her veins. We see they're hidden down there. They're protected. All those chemicals go into that and eventually make their ways down the ravines and down the creeks and into the larger water system. We have the city of Regina releasing a little extra effluent every now and then into our water system, unbeknownst to us as citizens of this city. They do that. And then that all runs down. And then you combine that with other communities. By the time it gets down to the Capel River system, Crooked Lake Valley, it's pretty gross. In fact, I hesitate to eat fish out of it now. I would not make that my sole collection source of fish. In fact, I go up to La Ronge, where my aunt lives with her husband, and they cast a net for us. And I bring home fish that I know is a little less contaminated, you know. I would maybe eat one fish out of Capel Valley a month, to be totally honest. I would not go swimming in there after August long weekend, because then the water turns green. And if any of you have ever gone swimming when it's green, you're liable to get the itch. And that itself is a parasite that comes from birds. that drops into the water. So we really need to be conscious of what we're upstream from, what we're downstream from, because no matter what, our little impacts are, they build up and they culminate into the water system. And that tells you the health of our environment when you look at the health of our water system. I'm going to show you a couple of reports at the end that I look at, that I've found, that speak to the water quality and the water safety and security for the province of Saskatchewan. And let me tell you, that information isn't very, you know, readily available for us as average citizens. We actually have to go looking for it. Now, when we talk about decolonizing our thoughts and decolonizing our way, I know it's a foreign topic for a lot of people simply because it's so new. For some Indigenous people, reconciliation is something that they don't see any value in. But they're not looking at it from that seven generations perspective. As Indigenous people, we need to remember that we have to think about things in terms of seven generations, where we are the center. We are generation number four. We have three generations ahead of us, and we have three generations behind us. And if you ever listen to anyone talk about decisions that are made long-term in Indigenous culture, they think about that, the three behind us and the three before us and how they'll be impacted. We don't, as Indigenous people, when we're growing up, think about just ourselves. And you'll see a lot of resistance with Indigenous people when it comes to the changes of acts, laws, and policies that affect them, because they try to think long-term. We think in the now in our government, the way they talk to us. Like when Prime Minister Harper was in place, Bill C-31 and Bill C-45, budget bills, huge omnibus bills. But what was hidden in them was a release of our water protections, our environmental protections for our water sources in Canada. I'm hoping you've talked about that. 98% of the water systems in Canada lost their water protection. And Justin Trudeau, in his benevolence, gave us some of that back for the coast 2 years ago. But now we see what's happening with Kinder Morgan. And that in itself is a water thing. He tries hard to talk truth and reconciliation, but I don't think Justin Trudeau has actually decolonized his own thinking that way. Because he's only got a third of the coastal Indian support, the nation's support out there, for his Kinder Morgan pipeline. We don't hear about the other two-thirds that are against it, because they know that once the spill happens, like the Husky oil spill, which, by the way, took James Smith Cree Nation over a year with their own money buying their own environmental assessment tabled to the province to make them admit, yes, full remediation never did happen for that stretch of water. And indeed, forced our province to fine Husky for, you know, a few million dollars. You know, money is great, but it won't repair the bitumen that's still sitting at the bottom of the North Saskatchewan River. And we need to be conscious of those spills. When they say they're fully remediated, I tend to challenge them now because of that very fact that James Smith was able to prove using science that it never really happened. When you talk about the coastal protection, you talk about the things that live in the seabed, the floor of the seabed. You talk about mollusks, you're talking about oysters, you're talking about all the little tiny organisms that make things happen in our oceans. Bitumen itself, once it hits salt water, will sink like tar, and it will cover all of that. And that is the concern of coastal nations, that we cannot guarantee that if something were to happen, that we can repair that to make it habitable again for our swimming brothers and sisters in the oceans. And they also don't talk about the fact that one-third of the nations that signed on actually are part of an advisory committee that is funded by the federal government in the millions of dollars. We don't hear about that. We hear about the fact that they just don't want it built and they're using Indigenous sovereignty. We need to decolonize our thinking when we think about that and we assess those kind of issues, because we need to listen to the Indigenous people and why they feel it's important. And when you hear that they're more concerned about the fact that their coastal inlets might be damaged permanently, that it isn't about them, that's decolonization. A lot of youth are embracing decolonization, and I like that about them. This is a young lady, she's an activist, and she speaks about why decolonization is so important to us as a society.
Decolonization for me, I think, means building healthy relationships. And not just with other people, but with the natural world as well. That's a good place to start. The way I work towards decolonization is just little things in my daily life, thinking about things that are not necessarily the right way, but thinking about things in a different way, seeing different perspectives, always learning, so not just taking things as they are, always thinking about things more. Also, just taking action and being a part of community and being positive and not engaging with some of the more negative things that can happen. So not being a gossiper or not promoting violence or not being negative. So always trying to be positive, always learning, always bettering myself as a person. I think that's an active part of my decolonization.
Decolonize to me means learning about all the oppressive negative ideas and undoing that. So learning about lateral violence and how to get rid of that, learning about racism and how we act that out, and also learning about what healthy sexuality and healthy bodies, healthy mind is. So getting to know your true self, feeling good, feeling positive, really thinking about how we got here and how we can work on being healthy for the future.
I also think that just learning more of culture and language, but also learning in this Western way, learning gaining a Western education is also very important to decolonize. So not, although it may seem kind of backwards, it's kind of like we have to have the Western world and our traditional world hand in hand now and move forward with that in the best way that we can.
I like that idea that we have to work with our Western world and our traditional world and work hand in hand. Try to marry the two together, because up till now, that hasn't been the dialogue. And culture is never static. It never stays in one place. It's not stationary. It evolves through time. And globalization has been happening since the creation of the pyramids. You know, it isn't something that's new, and it isn't this economic thing that we talk about in today's society. Globalization has been happening since the first person walked past their community and met another one. So because of that and that evolution of our societies on a global level, we need to figure out as indigenous peoples and as settler neighbors how our two cultures can marry together to focus on a common goal, and that is taking care of our mother nature, of Mother Earth, of Turtle Island, because we cannot live and we cannot survive, it's a proven fact, without the health and the well-being of Turtle Island. So decolonization itself helps restore indigenous worldviews. It helps embrace that. The United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Persons, right? A huge document that was agreed upon on an international level to embrace the rights of indigenous people and why they're so important to ourselves and the earth. Even though Canada begrudgingly had signed on to it, they were one of four nations that refused to sign it when it first was tabled in the UN. One of four. Canada. One of four. And only signing it by saying, we will sign as long as it does not supersede Canadian law, which also includes the Indian Act. So we're still having a problem in Canada with where governments treat and respect Indigenous rights. They still need to trump us, and they still need to make sure that they have the overall authority, and their law is binding first. Which is why we have these breakdowns in dialogue, and why we're talking about decolonizing now, because until we force our governments and we force our leaders to look at it from that perspective, the rights of indigenous people, we're still going to have issues and we're still going to have problems in society. Decolonization is also helping our youth and in our communities restore their traditional and cultural ways. And like I said, things never stay the same. But we certainly can enhance them and make them better than they are today. We have a really wonderful school here in the city, Mother Teresa School, right? They're helping Indigenous children regain some of that respect and culture for themselves. Our school boards are starting to bring that back in and try to adopt more Indigenous teachings. More elders are coming into our schools. That's wonderful and that's terrific. The fact that we're doing something as simple as acknowledging that we're on Treaty 4 territory and the traditional home of the Métis is also something very powerful, because before that kind of recognition was never accepted or never really a common thing. And it seems like more and more I'm coming to these gatherings and I'm hearing that traditional welcome and that acknowledgement more and more. And to me, every time I hear it, I think, yes, that's decolonizing. That's reconciliation. That little thing of acknowledging where you are is important. It also gives young people and elders the opportunity to have their voice and be recognized in a way that hasn't been done before. We also need to look at how we talk about the interpretation of the colonization of Canada. We've heard it from a strictly governmental perspective, from a colonizing perspective. And the reality is there's a whole other side to the colonization of Canada that we haven't had the opportunity to learn about or teach our children, or our children learn from other people. So we need to really think about things like that. Kairos, the group that first brought this decolonization in the watershed workshop to Saskatchewan, also has something called the blanket exercise. Now, how many people have actually ever participated in the blanket exercise? Okay, half, that's beautiful. Blanket exercise is actually a quick 45-minute workshop in the colonization of Canada. And you walk through the footsteps of an Indigenous person through the whole thing. And that is an eye-opener. If you haven't participated, I'm gonna plug a little activity later on, and hopefully you'll attend one of them. But the blanket exercise is also a great way to learn about the colonization of Canada from Indigenous person's perspective. That in itself, if you were to ever go to a blanket exercise or to a workshop that talks about these sorts of things, is a reconciliation. So it isn't like a really highly evolved thought. This is something really simple that we all can participate in. And let me tell you, when you participate in those kind of things, it changes how you work, how you walk from that moment forward. It changes how you look at a person on the street. I don't know how many of you, and I'm guilty of this, I have been guilty of this in the past. You walk by someone on the street and you automatically think something negative in your mind. And you walk by them and you think, oh, you know. But when you participate in something like a blanket exercise, you'll see that person for what probably happened to them and what led them to where they are today. Well, we have places like Carmichael Outreach. Why we have places like Circle Project. Why we have all these organizations that are working really hard to empower Indigenous people have been developed for a very precise reason, and it was due to the actions of colonization on Indigenous people, of the stripping of the culture, of the dehumanizing of people. Now, when I walked up, I noticed on the top of the building it said something about Christ and science together. Well, I believe that both are part of this world, spirituality and science. One, in my mind, cannot exist without the other in our society. And for me, when I talk about science, I'm thinking about it from a DNA level. There are a lot of scientific studies coming out saying trauma is actually recorded in our DNA. That the traumas we face as individuals, they're imprinted on us forever. And we pass it down to our children. When I think about it from a scientific perspective, I remember biology, grade 6, grade 7, fight or flight, the theory of survival. To me, that traumatic imprinting on our DNA is that whole theory of fight or flight. When you experience trauma that scares you, that might damage you, that might hurt you, we record that and we pass it on. And I think that if you ever talk to an Indigenous person who has a brother or a sister or a father, grandfather, mother, whatever, that went to residential school, you ask them, are you ever anxious? Do you ever feel like you're just not prepared for something all the time? 99% of the time they're going to tell you yes. And to me, that's that genetic marker, that DNA, that mark on our DNA. And we're going to have to, as Indigenous people, try to figure out how to get past that anxiety so that we don't continue to pass it on to our children. My parents and my grandparents are residential school survivors. I went to day school before I got moved to the town school. I had anxiety. I used to have massive test anxiety. I would study all night for, an average thematic test in school. I'd prepare for my university documents like 3-4 days in the library. I'd over-prepare to the point where I felt secure. And that is because of anxiety. And my mom's like that. And my sister's like that. My brother's like that. My daughter, a little less. I notice it. But she's still there. I can see the clouds in her mind sometimes, in her eyes. She's so nervous. But I know that this is probably why, this genetic mark. Now hopefully my grandchildren will have less of that. And I think about it in our cultural practices, 7 teachings. It's going to take 7 teachings, 7 generations to get past that. If we practice decolonization. If we continue down the road, it would just perpetuate itself. So for me, decolonizing is also that. It's trying to teach my children how to be okay with being a little bit nervous all the time. Letting it be natural. Not letting it envelop them and make it part of everything they do in life and constantly worry. And I guarantee you a lot of Indigenous people walking down the street are worrying about something. Whether it's their job, whether it's a test, whether it's getting bread on the table, you know, they're worried about something. So when we talk about our watershed, how do I decolonize my ideas about the watershed in southern Saskatchewan? There are very simple things we can do in our daily life. Like in our kitchen, we can use water-safe taps. That is something in itself is water security. You're being conscious. If you're in the bathroom and you're brushing your teeth, you're not letting the tap run all the time. You turn it off when you're done. You have the water thing on the shower. Some of us do it because we want to save on our water bill. Granted. That's a very good reason too. Who wants to give extra money for something to run down the drain anyways? But that in itself is protecting the water. People don't realize that these practices came about because of people who are ecologically conscious. These devices that we use in our homes, the low pressure spouts and all this such, they came because of ecologists wanting to protect Mother Earth and knowing that water is not an infinite resource, it's very finite. The laundry room, using these high efficient machines, they're fairly nice and water, you know, you very little water in them, I've noticed. And our garden and our lawn care, practicing the alternate day watering in the city, or better yet, not watering at all. My brother-in-law, bless his soul, everything's on a timer. He uses his alternate day. He loves that Kentucky bluegrass he has in the front yard. He covets it. Okay, but at least he's practicing the alternate watering days. And when he looks after the dandelions, which he doesn't like because it keeps, you know, puts a spot of color in his green, brilliant thermal green lawn, he uses that little stake and he pushes down and he twists it and pops it up. No more dandelion. Doesn't use Roundup because Roundup, once you rinse it off your lawn, carries down into the drain, hits the water, you know, the sewer system, and then back into the Capella River. There is a whole gamut of chemical-free pesticides that you can utilize. That in itself is decolonizing. But if you're like my husband, you don't water. And our grass isn't the brilliant emerald green. It's kind of green. Sometimes it turns a little brown. But we don't utilize the water that way. We don't have 20-minute showers. We don't buy bottled water. How many people worry about the price of gas? Every single one of us, every single one of us, $1.20, $1.30 on the coast. It's supposed to be $1.50 come summer. But how many of us use bottled water? 5-gallon jug, $6. You're paying $2 a liter for water. That comes out of your tap and you can drink it, by the way. Something free. Technically, we pay a little bit, but we don't pay $2 a liter. $2 a liter, $1.75 a liter. Think about it. We don't worry about that anymore. I was in high school when the first bottle of water came in the SO in our hometown. I laughed my face off because I'm like, what kind of fool is going to buy 2 cups of water when we have a faucet and we have a tap right outside the building? That's going to go down like, you know, a stone. Now we're all running to Culligan. We all need that water filter jug thingy that we plug in that uses power to keep the water cold for us. Or we can just turn around, grab a cup out of the sink, turn on the tap, there we go. That in itself is something no one's ever thought. I keep thinking, telling people, bottled water, something so simple. Culligan has made a whole industry, has had made a whole business of telling us that the water they're selling us is clean and pure and ready for us to go. But we can switch on the tap and drink the same damn thing. It just hasn't had a UV light run through it. UV light. If they had to build a UV light, it has chemicals in it itself. When that UV light is done, where does it go? Probably to landfill. These things we need to think about. That is decolonizing in your daily life. Now, maybe I overassess things, maybe, perhaps. It's probably true, but who cares? You know, it helps my little anxiety feel better about stuff. Think about the lakes and the rivers we utilize. A lot of us go, a lot of our families and a lot of our neighbors go to the rivers for recreation. We go there with our big boats. We go there with our pontoons. If you go to Lake Diefenbaker, you know, we enjoy it. But what we don't really think about is everything that we leave behind. Nothing more frustrating for me to go to the beach with my granddaughter and seeing refuse and garbage floating in the swimming area. It would have taken that person 10 seconds after eating that Eat More bar to stick that in their garbage in their pocket and take it home. But it's, you know, also easy to do this over your shoulder. We need to make sure that we do anything we do in terms of recreation with our natural waterways is environmentally friendly, that we think about what we're taking there and what we're bringing back. And it also comes with, when we talk about things we leave behind, let's talk about invasive species. In the prairie provinces here, the one thing my dad hates, leafy spurge. Hates it with a passion because it's this tall plant, it invades everything, it'll suck the lifeblood out of the land. It'll take where we had beautiful natural grass, where we had sage growing, it'll just absorb everything. And at first, when we first started getting leafy spurge in our pasture land, which, by the way, leafy spurge takes up the grassland, the natural foraging for our wildlife, for my father's cattle, for my father's sheep, he tried using Roundup. So he'd spray the leafy spurge. It would turn orange, because it's originally yellow. You can't say it's turning yellow to die. Turn orange and brown, and then fall over. But then a week later, right where that one was, another one pops up, because the roots of it, they go down many feet, and they're impossible to kill. He's now reverted to using natural ways to try to get rid of leafy spurge, a leafy spurge beetle, which was part of the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Program. He broadcast all those. We went in with a big net and swooped leafy spurge beetles out of a colony, brought them back home and dropped in my dad's land. It's been 10 years and he has 2 active colonies that are very slowly eating the leafy spurge, but it takes many, many years for these colonies to develop themselves. What he's also done, which is more aggressive and helps get his pasture lands and his grasslands back to natural, is bringing in sheep. Sheep actually will dig down and eat the roots because they're so tender and juicy, and they're very persistent. So for 3 years, he hired a sheep herder and his sheep to come in and move around in the grasslands and very slowly eat all the leafy spurge. Leafy spurge was brought here because it has a nice, cute little flower, and it was used for gardening, and then it just took off, and it's invaded a lot of southern Saskatchewan. So doesn't work with chemicals. I think my dad tried for 2 years to get rid of it with chemicals, and he realized the futility of it and realized what he was doing. And now he's gone back to natural practices. We have things like in Ontario, they have in BC in the Kootenays, just southeast of Calgary, 3 hours, right in the foothills there. They have something called a water lily, or a water tulip. Yellow iris. And it is taking over marshlands. And it's disrupting that natural habitat of the natural ecosystem. All these things that were brought over at one point had some good reason, but they're not natural and native to the grasslands and to Canada. And those things naturally will take over, like zebra mussels. If you're familiar with Manitoba, Lake Winnipeg, zebra mussels came in on boats, stuck to boats, and now they're decimating the natural biosphere of Lake Winnipeg. And they're making their way up here, by the way, where I was upstream or downstream from something or someone. So there's coming this way. Those, like fish people throw in the water. There's flying carp I've seen once in the States. These carp that come in and totally take over a lake. They're foreign there. I think they're from Asia. But they survive and thrive in our natural waterways. And they're actually making their way up from where they were dropped off in the southern states. They're making their way up the waterfalls, the waterbed, the water tables, to the point where just south of us in the States, they have nets across the tributaries to try to catch these fish, to try to stop them from coming any further north. And we're north of those states. So we need to be very conscious of what we put in our water systems. You know, something as blasé as a plant or throwing a fish in that we think won't survive has very dramatic impacts if they survive and thrive. So, you know, keep track of those little articles because we never see them. You know, you actually have to dig for this information. But once you're awake, you'll start to see them and you'll start looking for them if you find they're interesting to you. Decolonizing your ideas on industry. Petroleum-based industry in Saskatchewan and Alberta, very, very, very dominant in our economy, right? We're paying more per liter than we were paying last year. 2 years ago, the price of oil per barrel was, I think, $125 a barrel. and we were paying 7 cents a liter less for our gas at the pump than we are now. And right now, the price of Canadian crude, I think right now, is around 70. So be conscious of our economics and how they impact us as regular citizens, but how the petroleum-based industries are taking advantage of our natural wildlife and our natural settings. Those pipelines themselves and those pump tracks, when they are done and they've exhausted that location, they cap it with cement. What they do to extract that stuff is they have this proprietary recipe of chemicals that they shoot down there in the form of steam to release that crude, that bitumen, and they bring it up and they process it so they can send it off to foreign markets to be cleaned. Our own commodity isn't good enough for us to use. We send it to China to use. But when it's all said and done and that cement is poured and that well is capped, there is no guarantee that well will permanently stay capped. And when with that chemical mix they use, they inject it back down into where they took out the crude, the bitumen, and it sits there. So we have pods, if you will, of this proprietary chemical cocktail sitting in these wells capped with cement. And only the industry knows how they take care of that from beginning to end. And when they walk away, our International Environmental Protection Acts don't protect us or Mother Nature or Turtle Island. They protect the industry. That is something we need to be very conscious of when we say we need an oil and gas industry. Who needs who is my question. Green energy sources, I think, are a really beautiful thing to talk about in these kind of situations. People say, well, stop driving your car then. We have a whole century of being reliant on our industrial age. And to expect us as the here and now to flip a switch is very, very radical thinking. And I challenge people to actually say, well, you know, if you don't like the way things are, how do you feel when an Indigenous person tells you just go back to where you came from? That just is not going to happen. I don't expect it to happen as an Indigenous person. I don't expect my settler neighbors to do that. Take that, transpose it to petroleum. I'm not going to be in an electric car tomorrow, but it is my intention to be someday. I don't buy new because, quite frankly, my 10-year-old truck is doing me just fine. I don't have two vehicles in my family. I have one. We always have been a one-vehicle family. That was a choice we made because we felt it was very frivolous and extravagant to have two vehicles, to pay licensing for two vehicles, to buy two vehicles, to put gas in two vehicles, when really I seem to survive quite fine in my mom and dad's, you know, sedan. One sedan. And we live 20 minutes out of town. If me and my husband living in Regina, working in Regina, need two vehicles, we need to look at how we value things, in my perspective. So we've always been a one-car family. We've never bought new. I love that about us. That was something we made specifically. We made that decision specifically because we did not want to burden our environment. Surprisingly, second to humans, our agricultural-based industry is the most detrimental to our watershed. Because we drain wetlands, which are Mother Nature's natural sponges. They're the cleansers of the water system. You look at a boggy wetland, it's you can tell it filters. You look at peat moss and peat water, it's brown. It filters all these stuff out, and natural Mother Nature has over millennia created these wetlands to cleanse. And once that water is done being cleansed on the surface, it goes further down to a water table and another water table and another water table. And it's a series of drains and sponges and cleansers till it gets to the original one, back to Mother Nature's veins. And I remind you that, again, we still as humans don't know how our water table works anywhere. We don't know. We don't understand. We don't even know where these water tables begin and end because they're so far underground. So when we do something to the surface, it eventually goes down and down and down and down and down. And if we continue to incorporate contaminants into these systems, eventually they're going to hit the bottom. And once they hit the bottom and ultimate final cleansing area, then I think it's pretty much crucial for any life on this planet. Because we've contaminated to the point where we can't clean it up. We don't know how long it would take, even if we did. Because we still don't understand what we're talking about yet as individuals and as people. So when we drain wetlands, we actually drain that very initial sponge for our water system. And then it creates this thing where all the water all of a sudden runs into one big area. And we'll talk about like the Quill Lakes. The Quill Lakes actually, if you look at topographically, before humans came along, was probably a gigantic lake. But because of colonization and then the event of farming on the prairies, it became farmland. The Quill Lakes farmers are terrified that they're going to lose more land because water just keeps building up and building up. But that's because we've drained wetlands all around it. And it's forced all that water to go there. And it's saline. Saline water does not become desalinated naturally. Once the Quill Lakes expands its boundaries, it's going to hit the Capel water system, which is fresh water. And then we're going to have saline water. And it's going to change the whole biodiversity of the Capel water system. So if you start paying attention, you're going to see a lot of back and forth between Saskatchewan Watershed Authority and the Quill Lakes farmers, and they have a whole group themselves that speak for them and their rights as farmers. And the concern is, where do we go from here? We have all this saline water, but where are we going with it? And we don't know. No one knows what we're going to do with the Quill Lakes. For us, living in southern Saskatchewan, being downstream from the Quill Lakes, we should be paying attention to what's going on there. And it all became, all because of draining the wetlands as agricultural people. The past practices of our chemical use on farms is still impacting our water systems today. We're finally seeing the garbage that we put in on our land in the 50s, 60s, 70s hit our water systems. That is why our water is so gross. That's why it's green. I remember being turning green, end of August when I was a little kid. And now it's already green in July. That's because of all the stuff that's at the bottom of the sediment. It isn't leached out yet. And I don't know how long it's going to take. Again, we don't know, right? So the past practices that we had in the past still impact us today. And like I said, not all water on the surface is visible. It's not there. The rest of it goes down, and we don't see what happens below us. And we need to keep remembering that what we put on top goes down, whether it's above stream and below stream, but below earth is where it matters, because that stuff just kind of sits there and builds up, and we don't know when it's going to finally come clean again. So those are some decolonization thoughts you need to think of. Uranium mining. Janssen, K+S, Mosaic, Saskatchewan Potash Corporation. We are sitting on a huge resource of potash in this province. But we don't know, again, it's a proprietary cocktail of drugs they use to sluice out that potash. We use water again to mine potash. In fact, in terms of the global uranium mining practices, it's the most ecological way to mine, is using solution, using water. The uranium mining industry in Saskatchewan has a very good lobbying group amongst themselves. They have massive lobbying power to try to talk to our province about how much water they're going to use in all these mines that are coming up. Now we look at it as a society and think, great, no, another resource for another economic boom for our communities. Our kids are going to have jobs. They're going to have long-term sustainable jobs. That's great. But that's one generation in that series of seven I keep bringing back to you. Uranium mining is proprietary information again. It took me 4 hours to realize that, of digging on the internet, of finding keywords in one search, and then doing another search with those keywords, finding more keywords and doing another search. So it took me 4 hours to find out that what the uranium mining does when it comes to fracking is they build a jack, a pump jack. You'll see them, a oil drilling. It's almost like an oil drilling rig. You can see them in Belle Plaine. And they drill down, and they drill sideways, and they'll shake up all the earth. They'll inject steam. They'll bring that steam up. They'll refine it. They'll put the saline garbage that they don't use in the end back into that pipe again, and then they'll cap it once they've exhausted it. Then they move a few kilometers over, and they do the same thing. And they move a few kilometers over, and they do the same thing. And every single one of those pods, in the end, they'll have columns like this side by side, will be full of that chemical cocktail and water, salinated water that we can't use again. And then they cap it. Well, when those companies are done extracting all that stuff, they're leaving us with water-filled tubes, in essence, where there used to be bedrock. Now, think about the stability of bedrock and then a pile of sluicy gravel. That's why we're having earthquakes happen on the prairies in Alberta. You hear about, you know, a 3 magnitude level earthquake in the middle of nowhere. That's because of the fracking wells that are below the old ones. We don't think about that in the here and now. What are we going to be left with when these companies are done with our resources? And we don't know what's going to happen with all that water that they're storing down there. Will it make its way back to the water system? We don't know. So that's something else you need to decolonize your thought about the petroleum-based and the uranium-based industries. So, now that I've filled you with a bunch of terror over our water system, what can we do as individuals if we want to explore decolonization, our thoughts, decolonization and our thoughts of the watershed? There, we can look at alternative options. That's the cedar box that the Truth and Reconciliation documents were put into. It's a ceremonial thing in the coastal nations to have a cedar box of ceremony. And it held all of the documents and all of the trauma that happened when the TRC inquiry went across the country, and there's 7 stops. And it was presented, and it's saved in that box. So that's a very important thing itself in culture. But when it comes to decolonizing our thoughts about the watershed, we can look at our alternative options. This right here is a wind turbine that is just outside of Regina here, southeast of us. It is on Kauza's First Nation land. Now, we see a lot of these all over the place. Beautiful things, right? They collect something that always occurs in the prairies, wind. My reserve is not looking at the actual turbine. They're looking at the battery pack. That's the battery pack that stores the energy that comes from that wind turbine. It's part of a 5-year study with the Saskatchewan Research Council. And they're looking at how we actually store the resource of the wind once we get it. Because right now, our technology does not store a good amount to make it useful for society. This was a 5-year project. It wasn't anticipated to make any revenue for my nation until year 3, because we did not know how this battery pack would store the energy. By year 1, at the end of year 1, we had net profit, and it's just built. So the study itself on the battery pack is successful. We already know this as a nation. And why are we so interested in this as a nation? Because we have a lot of communities in Canada that aren't accessible to our power grid. Northern Saskatchewan. The Kootenays, where my family lived, we moved our kids for 5 years. How often did the power go out for us because of a downed tree in a mountain somewhere that a helicopter had to get to? This battery pack could actually help generate and store revenues and money for communities that right now struggle. It could help people like farmers who don't want to be on the grid. When I go back home, when I retire, my intention is to live off-grid, my husband and I. So we research a lot of stuff when it comes to these sorts of energy storage capabilities. So I'm really proud of this project that my nation has developed. Sask Power has finally adopted a more aggressive measure of expanding our solar power capabilities. A lot of provinces, Ontario, in fact, you go into the farmland, you'll see a solar panel, a huge one, almost in every home site. And that feeds not only the home, but it puts power back into the grid, and then that's a little bit of a revenue for that homeowner. Saskatchewan finally is on board with this. And I can speak from personal experience. My husband works for the province, and he works for Crown Corporation. And he was at CIC's annual workshop a couple of years ago, and he asked the CEO of our former CEO of Sask Power what his thoughts were on solar power, and the guy said, "Oh well, you know, it's just a waste. It's just the environmentalists. We're just trying to placate the environmentalists, and you know, I don't really see it being a revenue or being a viable option." So what about that wind power? My husband says to him that turbine just outside of Regina. How is that working out? "So how's the weather?" the guy says. To the other guy beside him, my husband. "How's the weather? It's doing great, isn't it?" "Yeah, I wonder what we're going to talk about today." 6 months later, we have a new CEO. And this guy has now expanded the solar power project. So if you're interested, that is a great thing to start looking into. Tesla has actually developed an economical battery pack for solar power storage of the energy. Before 2 years ago, it would have cost you about $80,000 for their battery pack. Now they're making it more viable. Next year, it'll be a little more cheaper. Next year, it'll be more affordable. And the year after that. So focus on those kinds of things if you want to decolonize your own home or your own business. My uncle, who lives up in Aaron, he's from that nation up there. He is actually the only journey person north of Prince Albert who is can sign off on the expansion of solar power up there. And it's going like great guns. They're actually looking for a second journey person to put through the training. So these are things that we can do here too, right? If you're interested in learning more about decolonization practices and supporting people who are looking after our watersheds, there are a lot of land stewards out there. This is one of them, the Wascana Upper Qu'Appelle Watershed Association. They have their own website. They have regular meetings. They supply newsletters. They talk about wildlife management and practices. Closer to where I'm from, Crooked Lake, Round Lake there, we have Loro Qu'Appelle. So we have activist groups and lobby groups that try to help share information with us as citizens, and I really think we should do that. The other thing is social media. We have 6 corporations in North America that give us our media sources. If you ever watch Global and you change a channel, you hear the same damn thing on CTV. You change CTV, you hear the same dang thing on CBC now. You change the channel, so on and so forth. That's because there are 6 corporations that give us every ounce of media information and news that we get, and we don't even realize it. Whether it's a radio, whether it's print, whether it's TV, 6 corporations manage our media. So go to other places. Huffington Post is an independent media source, and they're really quite reliable. Start digging around, finding these places that are independent. The Briar Patch, our own magazine here in Regina, in Saskatchewan, is a great source for alternative news facts. In fact, they're expanding to Alberta next month, so I'm quite happy for them. Talk to your MLAs, talk to your MPs, ask them questions about these expansions, these projects. Talk and ask them about how they're working with towns and communities with their water resources and their water use. For every one person that writes a letter to their MP, the Hill considers that 100 voters. That's statistics. So if 10 people write letters, the House considers that 1,000 voters. The power of writing a letter or talking to your MP and MLA is unbelievable, and we take it for granted as citizens here in this province, in our country. Take more interest in your environmental acts and your laws. Know about the community consultation practices of these industries. There's a whole new potash corporation being developed along the Pipestone in southeastern Saskatchewan, and they're actually right now going through and having their community consultations. They're advertised in Leader Posts, so I keep track of them. Tell people to go to those meetings by all means. And finally, just to wrap up, one little inspirational video.
There's a teaching that's found within many Indigenous cultures that talks about the 7 generations. The need to consider our impacts on each other, on our environment, and for those faces who have yet to come. So when you see the 7 generations represented in a pictograph or in an illustration, you'll see that these 7 figures are connected. You'll see that there's a thread that binds all of them. And this again reinforces and really causes us to consider our relation, our interconnection, and our dependency on each other. From those that have come before us and for those that will come after us. The teaching places us within a continuum whereby each one of us has parents. You know, and for many of us, we've been lucky to spend time with them, to learn from them and to teach them. We've also, therefore, had grandparents. Many of us are lucky that we've had time to spend with them, to learn from them and to teach them. And though many of us don't remember it, and perhaps neither do they, we have had time with our great-grandparents. We've had time to learn from them, to teach them, and really absorb some of their journeys within their time under the earth.
If we're lucky, we'll each have a child. We'll have time to learn from them and to teach them. If we're really lucky, we'll also be able to spend time with our grandchildren. We'll have time to learn from them, we'll have time to teach them. And if we're really lucky, we'll be able to spend time with our great-grandchildren. The point being, though, is that each one of us spends time in each one of those areas. We spend time as a great-grandparent, a grandparent, you know, a parent, a child, a grandchild, and a great-grandchild. And so the foundational principle of the 7 generations, as I know it to be, is that our choices, our behaviors and our mistakes reverberate that far throughout history. And so really we challenge ourselves, we challenge each other to make our decisions and our impacts within creation, within that timeline, to respect and care for those seven generations.
So that's Algonquin College out in the East. And it's really nice to see these organizations developing and sharing these teachings. I am blessed that I still have my Mushim, my grandfather, with me. I am also blessed that he's still with me because he sees my grandchild and my grandchildren. I have two now. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter and a 4-day-old grandson. Yeah. So 5 generations. I have 5 generations in my family right now, and I'm smack in the middle. So to me, that's important. It's more than just that picture on the wall of 5 generations. It's the fact that I can take my granddaughter to land my grandfather looked after, and now that my father looks after, and that eventually I will look after. As indigenous farmer, my dad puts 1/3 of every single penny he gets off the land back into the land in sustainable practices. We are still a single family operation, fighting amongst a whole conglomerate of corporate farmers. But we understand and we know the land. I know where I can walk. I can know where I can visit. I know where we can drive, where we can't drive. Because we have a real tie to our land. And I anticipate giving that to my granddaughter. So when I talk about 7 generations, I'm in a 5-generation concept right now. And there's not too many people that can say that. And that we all still go back home to where we come from, in my family. And not too many people can say that anymore. So that in itself, recognizing and acknowledging the fact that we are all tied together. And that when you go home today, maybe you'll spend, you know, more time focusing on tying that all together. That in itself is decolonizing too. I could go on and on about this all day. And I could talk about decolonization and other aspects as well. And where I'd like to see us go forward. But to me, just sitting here today and being part of this is decolonizing your thoughts and waking up to this. So I thank you for inviting me in. I thank you for listening to me, and I give thanks that I have the opportunity to lend my voice to this as an Indigenous woman. As you can see, I am No Dapple, which is the Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock. Went there, visited the camp itself. Very fantastic camp at the time. Sustainable, ecological, garbage collection, recycling collection, composting. Thousands of people in one spot. To the point where I felt like I was in a city. Once the camp was closed down last year, after Trump got in and authorized the pipeline and they realized it was going to get violent, they didn't want to go that way because it was a peaceful resistance, the camp itself was taken down. And to this day, if you drive by that site, you wouldn't even know anyone was there. Ecological. The pipeline has spilled. Dapple has ruptured on Standing Rock land less than a year after it was built. And the courts at the beginning of March, actually said President Trump violated our laws. That pipeline should never have been built. Jurisprudence has given right to the indigenous rights of Standing Rock and other people and other nations. But they reserve right to make a decision on that. Because it's been built. So the courts are trying to figure out what a suitable remedy is. But indigenous rights have been upheld. And I am still No Dapple. So again, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. It's my honor and my privilege to be here with you today. And I wish all of you a great day and a great life. Thank you.